Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Yahoo has been a mainstay of the internet since the early days of the World Wide Web. The company has experienced its share of highs and lows over 20 years, but still it averages a billion users a month. Well, Yahoo's reputation took an enormous hit last week when we learned that hackers had again breached company security, this time stealing the account information of 500 million users. Worse yet, the hack happened 2 years ago and is just now coming to light. This hour of Radio Times will look at how the breach is affecting Yahoo users. Also, cybersecurity in general. There's been an increasing number of attacks on companies, individuals, and government, and we'll talk about the steps any of us should take to protect personal information. Do you feel your personal information is secure online? And what do you think of the Yahoo story? Give us a call at 888-477-9499 or tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Joining us this hour, Nicole Perlroth is cybersecurity reporter for the New York Times. Welcome, Nicole.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And Rick Forno is a senior lecturer in computer science and electrical engineering at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, where he directs the UMBC cybersecurity program. Hello, Rick.
Good morning.
Morning. So the account information for 500 million Yahoo users around the world has been hacked by what the company is saying is a state-sponsored actor. And we'll get to that in just a moment. But first, what's at stake for these consumers, Nicole?
Well, your email address has become such a big part of your digital identity these days that, and especially for Yahoo, a lot of people with Yahoo accounts have had these for a long time. They've tied up their bank account to them. They've tied medical records to them, financial trading accounts. So if a hacker can get your email address and if they can get a password, and in this case, Yahoo had encrypted the passwords that were stolen, though there's some debate about the extent to which they encrypted them, whether they did it in such a way that would be hard for hackers to crack. And there seems to be some consensus that they're not so hard to crack. And once they get that password, they can try that email account and that password across so many different sites and in seconds, and they can do billions of attempts. And so it really does put people at risk. And there were some other points of data lost too, like birth dates in some cases, I understand, and zip codes and that kind of thing.
Rick Forno, do we have any idea of who this state-sponsored actor might be?
Well, I think the immediate culprit, or at least what people would point the finger at right away, would be Russia. They're sort of the cyber boogeyman at the moment for anything that bad that happens with American computers. But I'd like to build on Nicole's point about the possibility for further damage here. The email address disclosures is bad enough, but if you have little bits of information, zip codes, birth dates, you can use these little tidbits to try to reset an account password and try to get in that way and take over the Yahoo account in question or related accounts at banks or other places. So really, this is a huge concern, I think, that in some ways probably goes back 15 or 20 years in terms of the scope, because Yahoo's been around for that long.
Rick Forno, what are some of the hallmarks of hacking? What should we look for?
Well, certainly, I mean, being aware of your account status is a good thing. If you suddenly see a bunch of charges made to your credit card or your bank account balance changes dramatically, that hopefully raises some concern in your head, and you'll look into it more. So being vigilant is always the good starting point, regardless of how much you may or may not use the internet for these things. Being aware of where you stand in the world is a plus. Beyond that, good cybersecurity practices, which I'm sure we'll talk more about,
yes,
over the hour. Changing your passwords regularly, not sharing passwords between various websites, things like that that we've been preaching for 10 or 15 years or longer. These basic practices are just as valuable today as they were 20 years ago.
And we will get into that in depth as we go through the hour. But Nicole, first back to Yahoo. This is not the first time Yahoo has suffered a huge security breach. As you write in the New York Times, I think it's today, a number of companies were hit by Chinese military hackers a few years back. And describe Google's reaction versus Yahoo's in that case.
Yeah, it's a little bit of a tale of two cities story. You might remember, your listeners might remember 6 years ago, Google came out and very courageously said that they had been hacked by China. And it was a really big deal at the time because it was the first time a company had stepped forward and voluntarily said, we've been hacked. And not only that, but Google, they pulled a lot of their resources out of China. It was the first time someone had really pointed a finger at China and not been afraid to say they'd been hacked. And in my reporting on that case, you know, Sergey Brin, Google's co-founder, really saw that attack as sort of a personal affront. And he made it really almost a personal mission to never see that happen again at Google. So Google was poaching security engineers away left and right with $100,000 signing bonuses. They were adding hundreds of people to their security team. They went, and over the last 6 years since that attack has happened, they've spent hundreds of millions of dollars, it's safe to say, on things like encryption and digital tripwires and intrusion detection systems, et cetera. So they really see security as their number one priority. And there's even an internal meme at Google that anytime someone complains about a corporate password reset or any kind of inconvenient security measure, they get flashed this sign that says never again. You know, just remember that the goal here is that we're never again going to let some state or some cyber criminal into our users' accounts or into our network. And that's really their mission these days. At Yahoo, there was a much more lackadaisical, for lack of a better word, approach to this attack. So in our story today, we report that Yahoo actually was breached in the same attack that Google suffered 6 years ago by China. And their approach to the problem was just different. They had a much more, a smaller team of security folks at Yahoo. They call themselves the Paranoids. And within the community, they're really known as this really small but very agile, passionate group of security folks that did as much as they possibly could to lock up Yahoo systems and to share threat data across Silicon Valley. But the problem was Yahoo's management has just had so many struggles over that same time period that, unlike what was happening at Google with Sergey Brin, they just were not committing meaningful dollars to security. So in some cases, they did great things, like they were encrypting the traffic that flowed between their data centers. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, they were not doing things like resetting passwords after a breach because they were worried that the simple inconvenience of it might drive their users to other email services.
I was going to say,
over those same few years, they've had another couple of breaches, some of them pretty embarrassing spam-type attacks. You sort of have seen the result of that approach play out over the last couple of years.
Yeah, and I was just going to say, bring Rick into this as well. This is what happens, I guess, when you don't jump right on a breach.
Yes, these problems, we're going to keep seeing them. And I think Nicole gave a really good, brief history of how these two different companies, their culture of security differed between Google and Yahoo. One of the insidious things about data breaches, and particularly the breach or theft of credentials to log in, is that you may not know in real time when this happens. So in the lead-in, you said this, this occurred a few years ago. Well, if it takes 2 or 3 years to detect a breach or a disclosure of data, the bad guys have had two or three years to do mischief already. So the minute you learn of the problem, you're already behind the curve in responding to it.
And why is there such a lag time?
Well, if you're not monitoring or aware of the problem, if you don't have the right tools and sensors in place and monitoring processes to look for suspicious activity, or if your user reports aren't properly filtered and acted upon, internal delays can lead to these years, this year-long interval.
Do you find that this is the case across the board with internet companies, that there is a long lag time?
It really depends on the company, their security culture, how much funding, and how proactive their security teams are. Google certainly had a very proactive security team in place, as we just heard. But other companies may not be as well-funded or as well, you know, resourced. And as a result, they deal with things the best they can, but just they may be short-staffed. And then they do the best they can with the resources they have, and that can lead to a delay between discovery, reporting, and then responding to a breach.
Nicole Perroth, give us a sense of the underground world of internet sites which buy and sell stolen data.
Sure. So in this case, it didn't really apply in Yahoo's case, but it did in a tangential way, which was over the last, I believe in August, some supposedly 200 million Yahoo accounts and passwords went for sale on an underground marketplace called The Real Deal, where people can buy and sell user credentials anonymously. And that really tipped off Yahoo to just start looking around and seeing if they had been breached in some way. And what they found was actually that these email addresses that had appeared on this underground site were not from a breach at Yahoo. They were from a breach on some other third-party service. But when they did a deep dive into their systems, they discovered that actually there was this two-year-old, more sophisticated breach that they had not detected. But these sites, you know, cyber criminals are trafficking in your credentials constantly. It's a pretty sophisticated marketplace at this time, and there are several markets on what we call the underground web where these are bought and traded and sold in packages by the hundreds of millions. And hackers can buy those, and they can test them across multiple sites, sort of what Rick and I were discussing earlier. You know, it's not so valuable to break into your Twitter account with your email and password, but those same credentials are so often used across more valuable sites like your online banking site.
Rick, so is this something that the average consumer just needs to keep in mind? Perhaps not, you know, stay up at night worrying about it, but really when we approach our use of the internet, we need to know that's there.
Exactly. It's just like driving a car. You have to be cognizant of the traffic rules, the rules of the road, the drivers around you, and drive defensively. The same thing applies on the internet. We have to practice safe computing and take some basic protections to ensure that we're, you know, working and living in a defensive way online to raise the bar and make it more difficult for this type of stuff to affect us.
And we're going to talk about more of those protections as we go through the hour. We're discussing the Yahoo breach, personal security online, and why we seem to be seeing more cyber attacks on companies, individuals, and the government. That's just ahead on Radio Times. If you'd like to join the conversation, here's the number. It's 888-477-9499. Do you feel secure online? Send us a note at radiotimes@whyy.org or tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Rick Forno is Senior Lecturer in Computer Science and Electrical Engineering at the University of Maryland Baltimore campus, and Nicole Perlroth is cybersecurity reporter for the New York Times. There's more just ahead. Stay with us. This is Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia, and I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Last week, Yahoo announced that 500 million accounts had been hacked, one of the biggest security breaches in history. We're talking about that and also personal security online. 888-477-9499 is the number to call. Nicole Perlroth is cybersecurity reporter for the New York Times. She's with us for the full hour, as is Rick Forno, senior lecturer in computer science and electrical engineering at the University of Maryland, the Baltimore campus. And Rick, back to you for a moment, talking about consumer protections. Do antivirus software or firewalls work?
Yes, they work against things we know about, to put it simply. The companies that produce these products, they examine malware and viruses and bad things on the internet and design signatures around them so that we know what to look for. The problem is we see more and more cases where people are being victimized by malicious code, malware, that they don't know about. The companies haven't seen before, what we call zero days. And that means that you're vulnerable until the protections can be updated to defend against it. Mm-hmm. And that's an ongoing problem in the security world. We've dealt with this for decades, so it's not a new concept. But these tools do work. They are considered part of best practices. I wouldn't run a computer without a firewall and other security tools in place and proper configurations. So that definitely is a good starting point, whether you're an expert user or a home user.
What is two-factor identification?
Two-factor identification is it's becoming more popular, and that's a way of going beyond just standard passwords to log into a service. So, for example, it might be that you connect to your bank's website and you type in your username and a password, then the bank will contact you by a text message and ask you to type in whatever number code they sent you on your phone. So you have to have possession of your phone to get that message to respond to the question that is presented on the website. So it's just another way of helping make it more difficult for a single password breach to cause a problem.
And Nicole Perwath, let's get back a little bit to what Yahoo is asking its consumers to do. We touched on passwords earlier in the show. What else? The consumers who
really
might be affected.
They're asking the users to change their passwords and to look out for suspicious activity. One of the things that was taken actually in the Yahoo breach that we didn't touch on was the security questions that people ask. You know, what's your mom's maiden name? What's the name of your first pet, et cetera? I believe in the Yahoo breach case, those were encrypted, but it might only be a matter of time before those are cracked too. And that is actually potentially pretty damning. You can use those questions to reset people's passwords across multiple sites, as Rick was saying earlier. So you really just have to be on the lookout for suspicious activity. And these days, that's just so hard because you often just forget the number of sites that now have your email and password out there. And so one of the things I tell people to do is just start with a simple inventory. Just try to go through your email and find out which sites you've subscribed to. And do change your passwords across those sites, or invest in a password manager like LastPass or 1Password that can help you do so.
And again, this is elementary, but the rules for coming up with a strong password.
The rules for coming up with a strong password, you know, I have changed my philosophy on this over the years. These days, my rule is come up with a phrase or a song lyric or something you can remember that's long and use that. Don't use your birthday or don't use a password you've used before. Use something long, use something memorable. Don't use the same password across multiple sites, which I realize is becoming harder and harder, but is so important. And like Rick was saying earlier, turn on two-factor authentication when you can. I can't tell you the number of times I've gotten a text message that said someone is trying to log into my Apple ID or my Google account or even my Twitter account. And thank God I had turned on two-factor authentication, so they would have needed a second code to get into my account.
And Rick Forno, if a site asks you if you want to store your password, what should the answer be?
I'm going to sound like a professor here for a minute and say it depends.
Okay.
It depends on your use of the site and your comfort level with the web browser or the password manager that you're using to store your passwords. Some sites that I frequent regularly, mostly news sites, I let my browser store the password, my user ID and password. If it gets breached, I'm not really that worried about if a newspaper's website, steals my user ID. I am concerned if a bank or a credit card company or a government website stores my information, but that's more important to me. That's sensitive information. So kind of building on what Nicole said, turning on two-factor authentication is useful. Some websites will not store your password. You will be unable to store the password, and that can be a good thing. But I would also say another countermeasure or a way to make it more difficult for a data breach to affect you is to set up different email accounts, different email addresses, so that, let's say, for newspapers and, you know, when you buy software or you're shopping for a car, you use what we call a disposable account of some sort, a free email account that's totally different from the email address that you would use for your banking purposes. So if one account gets compromised, you're probably not going to be compromised on the other account as well. It's not foolproof, but it helps kind of compartmentalize how you use the internet and the various sites.
And we've got calls and comments coming into 888-477-9499 or radiotimes@whyy.org. Let's get to some of them. We've got an email or a comment from Dave in Hatboro who asks, how secure are cell phones? And he asks about a couple of brands, Apple or Android. Are any more secure than others? Rick?
Again, it depends on how they're set up, obviously. Certainly, one of the biggest vulnerabilities with a cell phone is flat out just losing it or misplacing it and somebody finding it. So how you've locked the phone down in terms of encrypting the phone, turning on the security features, PIN numbers, things like that, is a good starting point. And then on the phone itself, make sure that you're using, you know, your web browser is secured. Maybe you're running an antivirus program on the phone to make sure that malware hopefully won't be able to cause any mischief on that device.
And let's get to Donna in Doylestown. Donna is live on Radio Times. Welcome, Donna.
Oh, thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question about the safety of students' school records. Our son is in middle school, and in the public school, all of their records are now electronic. And while parents have a portal that they can sign into with a password, our concerns are who else has access to this. While grades may not be so much of a concern, although perhaps in the future when they're an adult, it might be, it's more medical records, psychological records, sports physicals, credit card information. Yeah. And how are students' and children's information being protected when districts require it, and it may be for efficiency or reduction of paper or speed and not taking up employees' time sending in physical forms, meaning physical paper, when that's the only option that we can use, and we want to make sure that our children, when they're adults, their personal information is not available to be hacked to the world.
Thanks, Donna, for the call to Radio Times.
To the world.
Okay, Nicole Perlroth, what do you think?
Well, I would say, first of all, I would congratulate you on having a vigilant frame of mind about this. I think for people in my generation, we just sort of signed up for all these services, put all our medical records online, and now we're trying to backtrack as quickly as we can to find out what's out there and whether we've protected it. Whereas kids in schools these days have an opportunity to sort of start fresh, hopefully. So I would say, you know, there are laws that govern the use of our medical records that require that these be pretty strongly encrypted. But, you know, there's always a way in. I don't think that we can backtrack to paper medical records and school records these days, but yeah, you're right to ask the right questions, such as how is this encrypted? What kind of password requirements do you have? Is there two-factor authentication? Where are these stored? Who is securing these? What sort of antivirus is used? You're right to start asking those questions, and I think we all need to be asking those questions as we put more and more data online.
Yeah, vigilance is key. All right.
Exactly.
Rick Forno, it seems that increasingly we're hearing about cyber attacks against companies or governments or campaigns. For instance, the hack this summer of Democratic National Committee email, a recent example. But you say the desire to interfere with another country's internal political processes is nothing new. Could you get into that for us?
Sure. The idea of monitoring and trying to influence another country's elections or political processes is a historical fact of living on this planet. Countries for years, through their intelligence services or their military services, have monitored and they've used spies and other ways to modify public opinion in support of certain, you know, goals in foreign policy. So that's why I believe this. What we're seeing now is not, you know, anything new or, you know, revealing. All it is taking traditional modes of international relations and intelligence and moving into the cyber arena. And we're seeing computers, which run much of the free world, being used as the new battleground for these types of influence operations.
Well, we also learned last week that hackers posted hundreds of emails from a Democratic operative, emails which detail schedules and the planned whereabouts of Joe Biden, Michelle Obama, Hillary Clinton, which sounds like a security nightmare. And Nicole Perlroth, this information came from the personal Gmail account of a Democratic operative. Are personal accounts here particularly vulnerable?
They are particularly vulnerable. They don't have the same sort of security that your employer usually puts on the enterprise. They obviously contain more personal information than we usually put into our work email addresses. But what I found to be really disconcerting over the last couple of months in studying up on some of these cyber espionage campaigns is the personal accounts of our friends and family are now very worthy targets for our adversaries, particularly in Russia. They are the latest boogeyman, as Rick mentioned earlier. But we are learning that personal accounts are regularly being targeted. And even if you're vigilant, congratulations for you. But hackers and nation state hackers know that if they can't get into your email address, they can just as well get into your spouse's email address and target you from their email address, or at least just search your spouse's email for any kind of embarrassing personal information. In this case, they targeted a low-level White House staffer who had Michelle Obama's passport scan and Joe Biden's travel movements and Hillary Clinton. So this is a strategy, and we're going to see more and more of it.
Well, and considering Hillary Clinton's email controversy, you know, and now what we're hearing about these hackers with this Democratic operative, should there be a hard and fast rule in government against the use of personal accounts moving forward? If there isn't already, I'm a little surprised that this happened. And are you, Nicole?
I'm not surprised it happened. It's so hard to keep track of what people put in their personal email accounts, and especially for government workers, it's pretty hard for them in some cases to access their work network and work email when they're out and about. And so a lot of people just end up using their personal email addresses. But yes, there's been some effort by the government to prohibit this. And I think even last May, Congress banned congressional staffers from using personal Yahoo accounts because so many of them were being targeted with what's called ransomware, where they can use these email addresses and access to encrypt people's data and hold it for ransom. So there is more of an awareness around the dangers of using less secure personal email addresses. There's more awareness around what we're putting in our email addresses. And there's certainly greater awareness around the dangers of using a personal email address, particularly if you are a government employee.
Rick Ford, now let's talk about the reaction of the government to the DNC hacking. In the New York Times today, there's a story about a young Russian. I think he's the only person implicated in this hacking. And his name, I believe, Vladimir Fomenko. He lives in Siberia. And Fomenko is very open in saying the FBI hasn't yet asked him about the case. What do you make of that?
Well, I think we're still in the early innings of this latest round of cyber espionage incidents this year. It's a very politically sensitive process for any number of reasons. I mean, there are diplomatic concerns, obviously. There are personal and political concerns involved with how we respond. There are some in Washington who would say we should respond to a foreign act like this with kinetic weapons. You attacked us in cyberspace, we're going to bomb you. Well, that sounds nice in theory, but the reality is, cyber doesn't work that way. So we see things like economic sanctions and, going on certain most wanted lists as ways of escalating the tension or escalating the sanctions against those accused of these activities. We saw that happen with some Chinese and North Korean military officers last year after the Sony hack, where their assets were seized and they were put on international watch lists and things like that. But it's very difficult to prosecute and go after attackers in cyberspace because they could really come from anywhere in the world, and it's not as simple as just pointing to a spot on the map and saying, we're going to get you.
And Nicole, back to Yahoo, worth noting, on Tuesday, you wrote a number of senators wrote Yahoo chief executive Marissa Mayer about the incident. What was the nature of that communication and what was the goal?
I think the goal is they want to understand more about how this could have happened 2 years ago and gone undetected. Which is a fairly typical response in cases like this. You know, in Yahoo's defense, I would say this. Nation state attacks are, in many cases, sometimes they're pretty basic, but in many cases, they're very sophisticated. And increasingly, we are expecting our companies in the private sector to defend themselves against nation state attacks. And we're expecting them to build up their own mini intelligence units and to spend hundreds of millions of dollars on security to keep us safe. And it's getting harder and harder to do so. And so, yes, you know, the senators are asking Yahoo to cooperate and disclose more about how this could have possibly happened. And they didn't detect it for 2 years. But let's not forget that last year we found out that the Office of Personnel Management was breached, and that did not go detected for quite a long time. So I think there's a certain amount of victim blaming that goes on after a breach of this nature, especially in Yahoo's case when half a billion people are impacted.
Sure.
But I think we also need to look at the problem here, and it's not always the victim's fault. And these things are really difficult to detect.
Okay, Nicole Perlroth is cybersecurity reporter for The New York Times. Rick Forno, senior lecturer in computer science and electrical engineering at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. We're talking about the Yahoo breach and more. On Radio Times, there's more just ahead. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. And this hour, we're talking about the Yahoo breach and personal security online. Also, why we seem to be seeing more cyber attacks on companies and the government and individuals. Our guests this hour are Rick Forno, senior lecturer in computer science and electrical engineering at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. And Nicole Perlroth is cybersecurity reporter for The New York Times. And we've got calls and comments coming in to 888-477-9499, or you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times, and we'll get to some of those calls and comments in just a moment. But one more question regarding Yahoo before we move on. Verizon's in the process of acquiring Yahoo for nearly $5 billion. Nicole, do we know how this shakes out for Verizon at the moment?
We don't yet know, and usually in these cases, because cyber attacks are so common these days, usually the deals are protected in certain contract clauses. And right now we don't have any reason to suspect this is going to impact the sale price. But when you're talking about a user base of this size and the potential class action lawsuits and liabilities, there could be some impact. We just don't know what it's going to be yet.
And Rick Forno, is it standard procedure for a company like Verizon to do security testing before moving forward with such an enormous acquisition?
Oh, certainly. Yeah, a company, large or small, as part of the acquisition process, would do due diligence, not just of the financial books and the records and profit and loss statements, but also the, you know, the buildings, the facilities, and the networks. I know back during the dot-com days, I participated and led several of these activities on companies that we were looking to acquire. And we looked at their cybersecurity posture, what technologies they have in place, and what tools were there to know, hopefully have a better idea of what we were getting into were we to acquire the company.
Right, let's get to the telephones. Liam in Bucks County, welcome to Radio Times. Hi, Liam.
Hey, thank you very much for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I want to take a moment to thank the guests for being on. I don't think this topic can get talked about enough. I do web design for small businesses in my area, And one thing I've noticed is that a lot of them, when I try to bring up the security aspect, a lot of them start to get very intimidated, I feel like, by some of the language, even just as the guests were speaking about multi-factor authentication, password managers, things like that. I use all of it myself. It works wonderfully. It actually makes my life easier. But trying to get people to go that way has been very difficult. I'm curious what the guests think about convincing people, making it more relatable for them to get into.
All right. We appreciate the call to Radio Times, Liam. Rick, what do you think?
Well, he hits on a very interesting point, and one that's very close to my heart, is communicating not just the technologies, but the risks and the vulnerabilities of the Internet to the average user. I agree. There's a lot of jargon out there that really needs to be simplified in a way that the average user can understand and take action with. Throwing a bunch of jargon or best practices that are full of gobbledygook is not going to help a lot of the people online. We need to find ways to communicate best practices and, you know, good security measures in bite-sized chunks that are comfortable and understandable for the average user. In that regard, companies like Apple and Google, particularly on their mobile devices, they make it very easy to turn settings on and off. There's always room for improvement, but the user experience is such that it's not confusing, and particularly with Apple, it's not that intimidating.
All right, let's get to a comment from Steven, who says, I'm a software engineer. I personally use and recommend remembering an algorithm versus passwords. Use some letters from the name of the app or website mixed with some numbers and symbols to create a strong password. Then you have a different password for every site, but only have to remember how to reproduce it. Sounds simple, Nicole? Appealing?
Yes. Yes, I think, you know, everyone has their philosophy here, or just do what's easiest for you. If that means memorizing, you know, your favorite line from a movie, use that. Don't do something that you're going to easily forget, because then you're just going to get sucked into this, circle of frustration. And that's the biggest problem with security these days. It just feels so overwhelming and so frustrating to secure our data. But if you can come up with some simple rule that you can remember across different sites, and sometimes, I hate to say it, but sometimes the most secure thing is to just write down different passwords on a post-it note and put it on your computer. Now, Rick will probably be horrified by that, but the idea that someone's going to break into your house and get your post-it note, the chances of that happening are far lower than someone grabbing your password just by brute forcing a website or breaking into your computer from remotely and grabbing a file that contains all your passwords. So,
I have to confess. Yeah, I was going to say that's kind of what I do, Rick.
Actually, I am nodding my head in agreement because I've done that myself with some services networks that impose very onerous security requirements on the passwords. They must be 15 characters, capital letter, lowercase symbols. And I found out every day when I would go into this client site, I would have to stop and call and waste a half hour to get my password reset because I kept forgetting what the password was. And I couldn't use it from day to day to day because it kept changing. So I gave up after about a week and I just wrote the password down and kept it in my wallet. Now, I didn't say password is this. It was looked like a phone number or some random thing in my wallet. But yes, if you think writing down a password is an appropriate thing to do and you can protect that post-it note somewhere, I don't think that's a bad practice these days.
Yeah, back to paper in a way, right?
Sure.
So Rick, on another topic here, you write that what's changed as far as cybersecurity is the ability of individuals, governments, militaries, and criminal or terrorist organizations, the ability to use cyber weapons. How so?
Well, we're all in this together. And, you know, we all use the Internet. The Internet is inhabited by good people, good governments, and innocent bystanders. So tools that I might have on my laptop that I use in the classroom or as a consultant can also be weaponized and used to cause mischief against a website or a country or a government. So the technologies that allow us to live and enjoy and work online the way we do today can also be used against us. And it's very difficult, if not impossible, to program intent and say that a given tool, like an encrypted iPhone, can only be accessed by a good person. And if you're a terrorist, you can't use that feature. We can't program that level of security or assurance. So the U.S. government would consider this dual-use technology. Most of the time, it's for legitimate, good, law-abiding purposes. But these things, like most things man invents, can be used for malicious purposes as well.
Well, obviously, we've got a big election coming up, and it's not all that hard to apparently install malware in an electronic voting system. Nicole, care to address that?
Although
we do have a patchwork system in this country. So is it that big a concern?
You know, I'm actually, to be quite honest with you, pretty terrified about the upcoming election. We know that there's been attempts. There was one recently reported that Russia tried to infiltrate the British election, and the GCHQ was able to thwart it. I would love to think that we could do the same, but I sort of lose hope when you hear about things like the breach at the Office of Personnel Management and the breaches on the unclassified networks at the White House and State Department and the low-level operative just last week. So, I am very concerned about it, and I would like to learn a little bit more about it over the next couple of weeks. So expect a story from me in the next couple of weeks on this.
Okay. And at the same time, senior officials, intelligence officials, told Congress and the White House recently that Russian hackers, in their opinion, would not be able to alter the outcome of this presidential election. What is your sense of that, Nicole? Does that relieve the anxiety a little bit, at least in your mind as a reporter on cybersecurity?
Not at all. They've already, in some sense, impacted this election. There's still some debate over who exactly released the DNC emails, but we're pretty sure who was behind the initial hack on the DNC systems, and that was to Russian intelligence services. You saw what the impact of that was at the DNC, with people just being irate about certain DNC biases in the Democratic National Convention. So I think that this is already impacting the election, or already has in some sense. Whether they're going to actually hack into our digital ballot boxes, I don't know. I'm sure, though, that it would be safe to say that attempts will be made.
Rick Forno, what are your thoughts?
I share Nicole's concerns, but the way the U.S. Elections are designed at the state and local levels here, there is no U.S. election system that runs on a standard piece of software with standard voting machines. Some are touch screens, some are punch cards, some are paper ballot, whatever. So it's very difficult, if not impossible, for somebody overseas to hack in and change, enough votes in the country to skew the results. That said, this hodgepodge in one way does present a little more assurance because it is such a hodgepodge, and it's not all online or digital. But there are other aspects of the voting process, the voter registration databases, how the votes are tallied at the polling places, and how that data is reported to the state for official reporting that night. Those are all systems that may be vulnerable to external or internal attempts to influence and change the data. So that's what concerns me more than the security of an individual touchscreen digital voting machine somewhere.
So, Rick, what are you hearing about technologies that might be developed to strengthen election security?
Well, the first technology, or the first thing to do is find ways of funding the technology improvements needed to reassure people. The electoral process is primarily based on trust in the system and trust in the process. So we have voting machines that are digital that are 10 years old, and they've never been updated with new security patches and updates. Well, if you were running a 10-year-old computer at work or home and you'd never updated it, you'd be vulnerable to any number of things. So we have to find ways to increase the security of these devices, procure new ones, procure the updates to make these things more resilient to digital mischief, if you will. That's a good starting point. But again, the way the U.S. elections are designed, it's a state-by-state process. And one state may find the resources to make these improvements. Their neighbor may not.
So Nicole, in weighing in, I'm guessing you're thinking this is going to be a long process.
It is a long process, and there's been really great people looking into this for a couple of years, but I know they haven't been as successful as they would like to be. So it's just something that we really need to keep on our radars and be on the lookout for. I can tell you, in the intelligence community, what some of the concerns have been are, you know, on the email leak side, they're worried that
No, I think we might have lost Nicole there. Let's see if we can get her back for the last moment or so of the show. Rick Vorno, let's just take another comment or so as we
sure.
Begin to wrap up. We've got an email from a woman named Hillary who asks, what about DDoS, distributed denial of service attacks? She says, I play World of Warcraft and Blizzard often gets hit by DDoS attacks. They say the attacks hit their system providers. Why is it so hard to stop these groups? And do DDoS attacks cause anything else other than an inconvenience?
Sure. Here's some more complicated jargon, DDoS, distributed denial of service attacks. What this really comes down to is a series of computers, any number from, you know, two or three to tens or hundreds of thousands of computers, all sending internet traffic to a target computer. So in the case of Blizzard, you might have 100,000 computers around the world that have been infected with malware, let's say, that are launching a cyber attack against Blizzard, which renders its servers unresponsive or could knock them offline, in which case the users can't get on to play, they can't get on to administer their accounts or anything. So really, it's crowdsourcing an attack against a set of targets. Mm-hmm. We saw this most recently with a security reporter who was knocked off the internet through the largest denial of service attack we've seen. And the provider actually kicked him off because they didn't have the resources to keep his site running in the onslaught of all this digital data coming at them. So these attacks certainly are an inconvenience, but they can knock a site offline. So if you're a bank or a brokerage or an e-commerce site, certainly you want to stay functional. And DDoS attacks make that more difficult when they occur.
Okay. And we do have Nicole back here and a couple more moments to the show. Nicole, we're going to do a little conversational whiplash here as we go back to the election. And if you wanted to finish your thought about, how long it might take before we see some resolution in protection in cyberspace regarding elections. Do we have you back? Well, I guess not. All right. So, Rick, why don't we close in this way? In warning against a sense of complacency, Rick Forno, you quote Warren Buffett, it takes 20 years to build a reputation and 5 minutes to ruin it. How do you parse that out to cyberspace?
I think 5 minutes is an eternity in cyberspace, and a reputation can be destroyed very easily, very quickly in cyberspace. Sites can blink off the internet very quickly as well. So we have to be agile, we have to be responsive, and we have to be flexible to meet the constantly evolving nature of the threats that are out there so that we can live and work and be productive and safe online.
All right, Rick, thank you so much. Rick Forno is senior lecturer in computer science and electrical engineering at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. I'm told we have Nicole Perlroth back with us for the last two or three seconds of the show. Just enough time to thank you, Nicole, for your participation.
Thank you so much.
Nicole is a cybersecurity reporter for the New York Times. And I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Thanks so much for listening to Radio Times.